Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
Hi, Laura Kanoy here. All this week, we're playing back for you some of our favorite programs of 2019. And remember, because this show is not live, we will not take any new calls or comments. Thanks for listening. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. When it comes to New Hampshire animals, moose, bear, and bobcat tend to grab the most attention, including here on The Exchange, where we've talked many times about these creatures. But today, our focus is on those mammals people tend to care less about, maybe even regard as pests. Opossums, porcupines, and fishers, those house cat-sized animals who possess some incredible survival mechanisms, who affect the ecosystem more than we realize, and who also face their own struggles. So let's hear from you. What questions do you have about opossums, porcupines, or fishers? What encounters have you had with them? Let us know. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. With us for the hour, Patrick Tate, New Hampshire Fish and Game Fur Bearer Project Leader and a wildlife biologist. And Patrick, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Also with us, Ian McLeod, Executive Director of Squam Lakes Natural Science Center and former host of NHPR Something Wild. And Ian, a big welcome back to you, too. Thank you for being here.
Always great to be here, Lauren.
So I want to start with opossums. And just to let listeners know, we're going to deal with one critter at a time. So opossums first. And Ian, when I was growing up, I thought of these as a southern species, but now they seem pretty plentiful. A couple times a year, I see one waddling across my driveway. So what are they doing here?
Well, they're expanding their range further north. So they're one of the animals that's definitely been impacted by climate change, as our climate is generally getting warmer. Our winters are getting milder. And so opossums are taking advantage of that, and they've been spreading north gradually into New England. They're not quite up into Canada, maybe into Ontario, but we're sort of at the northern edge of their range. But they're you know, just capitalizing on the fact that they can survive, more of them can survive in the winter. Now, if we get a really severe snap, they are not designed, they're not evolved really for cold temperatures. They don't have thick fur. They have naked tails and ears, and so they suffer, you know, quite a bit from frostbite if we get cold, cold weather. So they're, you know, bad winters, they'll certainly get knocked back a little bit. But generally, they're just spreading further north and taking advantage of those milder winters.
How do they get here, Patrick?
Great question. When I was in college, that actually came up in one of my classes, and the demonstration we were presented as the trucking industry or the transportation industry combined with railroads. So on rail cars...
Wait, possums take the train?
A lot of wildlife takes the train.
Really?
Yeah. So they can get in spaces on those rail cars and tractor trailers. They get... A vessel goes 600-700 miles, trailer's dropped, rail car's dropped. The animal's then there to get off the wagon, say, and go start venturing around the various parts in that region. And interestingly... there's a virus that they spread called EPM, and it affects horses. And it's spread throughout the United States by grain storage. And so these animals get into grain storage. The grain will be trucked around. And sometimes the animals are in those vessels with the grain, and it moves around. So it's all tied to the transportation industry that has helped expand this animal's range and take advantage of the changing climates.
Well, that's the thing. So maybe 50 years ago, if an opossum... you know, hitched a ride on the train and came to New England, it wouldn't make it, but now it might make it through the winter because winters are shorter and a little bit warmer, as Ian said.
Yes. It still could have made it back, you know, 50 years ago or so, because it can get into human-dominated areas and get into warmer places within roof spaces or within semi-abandoned buildings. They can find warmth in those locations and take advantage of that.
Wow. So opossums hitch a ride on a train or a truck, and we don't even know it.
Well, we have natural reproduction in the state as well, but
right.
that's what helps spread their overall range.
Really interesting. Yeah. And again, I want to remind listeners, we'd love your questions about these three creatures that we're talking about today. Opossums, and then porcupines, and then fishers. Our number, 1-800 1-800-892-6477. So, Ian, can I say opossum or possum? Can I say possum? I know opossum is the official
word. Well, a lot of people will say possum, but the correct term is opossum, Virginia opossum, in fact. And it's one of several different opossums that are found in the Americas. The only one that sort of made it into North America is the Virginia opossum, but there are several other opossums down in South America. They're marsupials. They're the only North American marsupial. Of course, in Australia, there are animals that are also marsupials that are called possums. So they were named because they had a resemblance to the opossum that folks saw over here. And when they went to Australia, they went, oh, that looks like the opossum. And it ended up being called a possum. But it's interchangeable. People know what you're talking about. There's nothing really else that sounds like an opossum or a possum. So, you know, we'll forgive you if you don't put in that O at the beginning.
What's the difference between the Australian type and the North and South American types?
So our ones are very arboreal. They're very much a woodland climbing animal. I think the possums that are over in Australia are more of a ground animal that's sort of in burrows. And it doesn't have the same long tail that ours have. So quite a different animal. The opossum that we have here is a terrific tree climber. They use that prehensile tail to sort of as a fifth limb. People often comment on that long rat-like tail that's sort of bare.
It's big, yeah. It's
a very
ugly.
Long tail. And it's actually one of the disadvantages that they have. As I mentioned, they're not really designed for winters in New Hampshire. We quite often get them brought into the science center, and they'll have very obvious signs of frostbite. On their tail, on their ears, on their toes. I mean, they really don't do well in very, very cold snaps. But very much a great tree climber. They will hang on to trees. Of course, the little babies, the little joeys, as they're called, will hang on to their mom's tail as she's moving them around. So it's quite a fascinating little animal.
Well, and I have to ask you this. You use the term prehensile tail, and I've heard that a lot. So just what is that, Ian?
Well, basically means they're almost use it as a fifth limb.
I see.
So they're able to curl it around. It's almost like having an extra hand. They use it to hold on to things, to steady them. And they can. Most of the babies really do it. I think the larger adults have a hard time getting their whole body weight held by the tail, but the young little babies will often be curled up on the tail. It's not quite like in Disney movies where you see them all lined up, wrap their tails around, but they will certainly use it for a few seconds to hang on and help them climb.
So we talked about how they're not really adapted to New England winters and how, as you said, Ian, when there's a tough winter, the opossums have a tough time. Can we consider them, Patrick, an invasive species, if they really are a southern species that are now able to hang out here?
I have a tough time with the term invasive species of a species in the United States that is expanding its range. So I personally would not call Virginia possums an invasive species.
Okay. Because they're just a creature that's expanded its range
based on
changing climate.
They're native to North America. They're expanding their range based on climate change, correct. So I don't call them invasive.
Would you call them invasive, Ian?
No, absolutely not. No, I mean, it's very different from something like, the European starling, for instance, is a classic invasive species that's been brought from Europe by man. So to really be an invasive species, they're sort of brought here artificially by humans and introduced into an area where they can be disruptive and destructive. But as Pat said, they've come here on their own. Some of them have certainly been assisted by trucks, but they could have made it. They could have spread on their own and certainly have done.
Well, it'd be fascinating to watch them somehow do it on their own, not hitching a ride on the train or the truck, because they walk really slowly, Patrick, right? I mean, they're not rapid.
Yeah, they're slow walkers. It would have happened over a longer time period, meaning to spread a mile under their own feet takes a much longer time than a vehicle. But yeah, they're very slow walkers, and it's more of a waddle than a walk that I've seen.
So now that they're here, Patrick, but you too, Ian, what role do they play in our ecosystem?
They are a scavenging animal. They are a semi-predatory animal. They are there to clean up, deceased animals and whatnot. Partly there to help control some animals. There's pros and cons of that whole aspect of it. For instance, we've recently read in the headlines about birds being on decline.
Yeah, and we did a show on that a week or two ago.
Right.
Right.
And, well, one of the things that possums do is they're nest predators.
Oh, really? Because they can climb trees, so they'll go in the nest.
They'll ground nesters.
Oh, I did not know that.
A common thing we read about is the 5,000 ticks per season, which sounds fascinating, but it's actively grooming. They're not searching the landscape for those ticks and whatnot. And with that, we don't know the full effect they have on ticks, because various research I've read is a 1 acre of land can have anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000 ticks. And a home range of a possum can be anywhere from 12 acres to 250 acres. So when you do the math, and one adult female tick can lay 2,000 eggs, when you start doing the math, 5,000 ticks isn't a humongous aspect of it. So it gets very complicated there. Pros and cons to it, they certainly participate and help cleaning up the environment. That's being a pro. A con is that they do transfer other diseases as well. So I don't know. In the big picture of things, the final answer on that, they're an important part of the landscape, but I don't want to give this false impression that they're angel animals and they are these perfectly clean animals.
That's very interesting. Yeah. And maybe there's more to study because they're sort of newer in our ecosystem.
Our ecosystem.
Yeah,
however,
here
they're
in
not
New
England. Newer on the United States ecosystem.
Yes.
Yeah.
How would you describe their role in the ecosystem, Ian?
Well, they're definitely opportunists. As Pat said, they'll often feed on carrion. Apparently, they really crave calcium, and so they'll actually crunch on the bones, the skulls of roadkill animals or any other dead animal that they find as they're snuffling around in the woods. They will also, of course, get into garbage. That's where they tend to get in trouble. They certainly take advantage of human waste, and so they will tip over your garbage cans and get into all kinds of goodies in there. They'll scavenge around dumpsters where they can find French fries, and so they're opportunists. If we leave stuff out, if you leave cat food, which you never should do, or dog food on your back porch, they will happily come and eat it. So whatever whatever doesn't eat them first, opossums will eat it. They're very omnivorous and very wide ranging diet.
They seem incredibly adaptive. Someone called them nature's trash cans. So that kind of sounds like what you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, sort of. You know, I don't really like that term. But anyway, they're a little better than that. But I'm always fascinated when I see them. We don't see lots of them in the Lakes region where I am. Some winters we see more, and they're usually around towns. I've seen them in the middle of, downtown Plymouth. There's probably students there who are maybe leaving some things out that they shouldn't be leaving, and so they're finding things to eat in the town of Plymouth.
Oh, that's interesting.
I've seen them in Ashland where I live. So usually they're close to people. You don't really see them out in the woods. They're very much linked to where humans are, seem to be. And they find more shelter. They can get underneath porches, in basements of houses, places like that where they can get out of the cold weather and find something to eat.
That is interesting because, as I mentioned earlier, I live in town here in Concord, and I don't see them every day, but it's not unusual for me to see them. So that's why.
That's why, because they're close to humans. They definitely do like what we leave behind and what we, the places that we live provide them with some nice sheltered spots.
Well, Sheila sent us an email. Sheila says, when we first built on Route 27 in Hampton in 1988, we were aware we were displacing critters. Within a year, raccoon, deer, fox, possum, fishers, and skunks had found their way to our clearing. At our compost pile at night, all species would be out back feeding like the peaceful kingdom. But the funniest one was the possum, who hung out with my cats in the evening. When the cats came in, she tried to as well on several... she is the possum. When the cats came in, she tried to as well on several occasions. She brought the young ones to sit on my front step as she hunted. Wow. Sheila, what a story. And the young ones are kind of cute, by the way. Our producer, Jessica Hunt, put up pictures of the three critters that we're talking about today on our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. And there is a picture of a mother possum with three adorable babies sitting on the back. Sheila also says, the last fisher I have seen was 8 years ago. No problems with any of these creatures. And we're going to be talking about fishers later on today on the exchange. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Pat, describe how the babies grow. It's interesting. Sheila writes about the young ones because it's pretty fascinating. The mother, the Jill, as she's called, is only pregnant for 2 weeks.
Yes. And then when they're born, the young travel up and get into the pouch. And according to information I've read, they'll spend about 3 months in that pouch. And as they get towards the end of that, they'll begin to climb out of the pouch and move around, climb on her back, ride on her back, and be more exploratory. And after a number of weeks there, they'll be able to go out on their own. And interestingly, with reproduction in possum, they have two litters per year. And an old opossum is roughly 20 months. Very few of them live past 12 months.
Wow. An old opossum is 20 months.
Yeah. So they're not a long-lived species. Yeah.
And the babies, I read, are the size of rice grains at first, and they hang out in the pouch.
Right.
And she has a lot of babies, so even though they don't live a long time, you know, she'll have anywhere between 10 and 20.
Right, which is, from a biological standpoint, very, very high reproduction potential and distribution on the landscape once a few arrive. But because they're short-lived, that decreases that production to take over the world.
Wow, it's really interesting. What else is unique about opossums, Ian?
Well, just to continue on the discussion about the reproduction, what's fascinating is that the female has 13 nipples, but she can produce many more young than that. And so only 13 would be the maximum that would survive. So she may, you know, produce 20, but maybe only 13 of them, or maybe less, will actually make it, find a place in the pouch, find a nipple, and then the ones that don't make it, don't make it. So, you know, so that's sort of a limiting factor there, that the, you know, you won't generally see more than 13. I'm probably not possible to have more than 13, you know, trailing along behind mom. But that's a lot, yeah, even so. And a lot of them, of course, don't make it. That first year of life, first few months of life is very high mortality rate. And as Pat said, they're very, very short-lived animals. We have them at the Science Center as program animals, and we rarely get, even in captivity, where they don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from or getting into fights with other animals or getting hit by a car. We rarely get more than two or three years out of
them.
Wow. They're very, very, they
even
very
in that
quickly.
Cushy captive life.
Yeah, they very, very quickly age. It's just part of their metabolism, and they just sort of become an old animal very quickly and they die. So it's just part of their natural life cycle.
Should humans, Pat, be fearful of opossums?
Great question.
I mean, obviously, I'm not going to go up and pet the ones that are going across my driveway.
People shouldn't be fearful of possums, but they should respect possums and stay from them. There's a common misconception out there that possums do not carry rabies because of their low body temperature. They can carry rabies. It's very low rate of occurrence. In 2013, there was two in the United States, and I look back into the 1950s, there was examples from the 50s. So with that, I want to say don't fear them, but respect them. Don't handle an injured possum. There's a common misconception out there. We should check roadkill possums for younger in their pouch and remove them for rehabbers.
Yes, I had heard that.
Yeah, I as personally don't support that idea because of the dangers a person can put themselves in on the roadways dealing with motor vehicles, and also the dangers they can put themselves in handling the dead animal, because possums can carry tularemia. They can carry rabies, low chances, spotted fever, and a few other, leptospirosis. So there's a number of things that are big names, which some people, I'll take my chances, but the chances of these bad occurrences happening are low. However, when they do happen, they have very high consequences.
So for the person.
For the individual, human individual, yeah, person. So respect them, don't fear them, and recognize that they're adorable animal and they do belong here.
Well, that's interesting because I had read, again, you know, advice sometimes on the internet is not accurate, as you're saying, Pat, that because the female opossums have so many babies in their pouches, if you see one that looks injured, take it to the side of the road so that those babies can be saved. But you're saying, don't do it.
I'm saying it's not worth the human life risk to do that, given that it's a short-lived animal. It sounds very cold from hearing these things, but it's a short-lived animal. It's nature's not a friendly place, and I'm saying for a person to protect their health before risking their health for the animals.
A couple more emails came in about possums. This is great. John emails. He says, possums may be new to New Hampshire, but I grew up in Central Mass in the 1950s, and possums were a normal part of the fauna. My grandfather was a hunter and used to go out with his dogs and, quote, tree opossum, so I would say they are not new to New England. Karen is a native of Australia, and she says, love hearing about possums. I thought I should point out that we have many varieties of possums in Australia. Most notably are the ringtail possum, pygmy possum, and the sugar glider. All are adorable and much smaller, says Karen. Karen, thank you so much for that email. Good to hear from somebody where they have plentiful possums. We also heard from Weldon in Guilford, and he says, while I agree these three mammals play an important role in our ecosystem, I find New Hampshire Fish and Game's management of these species perplexing, to say the least. And he talks about the fisher. We're going to talk about that later. But he says the opossum plays a vital role in New Hampshire's ecosystem, not the least of which is helping to control the tick population. And yet, for 2.5 months in November, December, hunters can kill as many as they want. Other than to provide hunters with a live, slow-moving target, why does New Hampshire Fish and Game allow this? Why is there possum hunting, Patrick?
Well, I'll start off with the mission statement of the department. No, it's not verbatim. It's to conserve wildlife, educate the public about wildlife, and provide recreational opportunity to use those wildlife resources. There's a relatively long hunting season, depending on perspective. And part of that is because people simply don't hunt those animals. There's approximately 60,000 hunters who buy hunting licenses in the state. The majority of those hunters are targeting white-tailed deer, and then other species go down from there. So though the season's long, there's low use of that opportunity. In regards to, I'll move to trapping. I have the numbers from the previous 2 years. In 16, 17, 33 animals were taken by trapping. I see more than that roadkill in a given year. That same year, 149 possums were taken by wildlife control operators. Those are animals that were creating issues for landowners.
Got under somebody's porch or...
Or in some type of setting where they're concerned for issues. Usually, if they call about it under a porch, they're educated, they'll move on, and even with wildlife control operators. But if it's in a chicken coop or in an attic space, things like that.
One last question, and then I do want to move on to the two other animals that we're going to talk about today, porcupines and fishers. Ian Karen, our native of Australia, mentioned some of the names of possums in her native country, pygmy possum, sugar glider. I read that opossums used to be called grinners. Have you heard that? That's the old-fashioned name for possums and opossums?
I had not
grinners?
Heard that, no. I mean, I did. I was sort of doing a little research before the program, and I had not come across that.
Okay.
Interesting. I wonder if that's a local sort of colloquial name that people used.
We'll see.
Grinners. Huh?
Yeah, well, they certainly do have lots of teeth.
They do have lots of teeth. They have more teeth than any other mammal in North America, I believe. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they've got great teeth. Great teeth.
All right. Well, it's fascinating. And coming up, we're going to talk about another creature equally as fascinating with a completely different lifestyle in terms of reproduction and what it does on the landscape. We're going to be talking about porcupines coming up. We're also going to hear about a fungus that is affecting New Hampshire's porcupines. We'll have an expert from UNH talking about that. And we'll keep taking your emails. This is great. We'd love your stories and questions about these animals that we're talking about today. Again, we're talking about possums, porcupines, and fishers. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from UR subscribers and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
Hi, Laura Kanoy here. This program was recorded earlier, so we can't take any new calls or comments. Thanks for listening. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, three underappreciated animals in the Granite State, porcupine, opossum, and fisher. They don't grab headlines like moose or bear or bobcat. In fact, some people view them as pests. But as we're hearing, these mammals also play a role in our ecosystem, and some have had their own recent struggles. We're finding out more, and we've been hearing from you, your stories, questions, comments about your encounters with these three. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can tweet us, you can comment on Facebook, or you can call 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Patrick Tate, New Hampshire Fish and Game Fur Bearer Project Leader and Wildlife Biologist, along with Ian McLeod, Executive Director at the Squam Lakes Natural Science Center and former host of NHPR's Something Wild. And gentlemen, let's turn to porcupines. One Vermont naturalist wrote about porcupines recently. Most of us have been at least annoyed, if not infuriated, by porcupines from time to time. Ian, what do porcupines do that make them annoying or even infuriating, as she wrote?
Well, probably those are pet owners. You know, anyone who's got a dog who's gone out at night and come across a porcupine and ended up with a whole muzzle full of quills knows that there's an expensive veterinarian bill ahead of them. You know, porcupines have this very, very effective technique. Their quills, they don't throw their quills. There's one of those myths. People think they throw their quills. They don't. You have to actually
make... That would be quite a feat,
It would be quite a feat, but it's amazing how many people think that's the case. They'll go, oh, they throw their quills. You know, that's not the case. You have to make contact, or they have to make contact with you. And they do that through sort of muscle spasms. And so as the dog, of course, chases after it and gets its nose right up to the backside of the porcupine, it sort of lashes its tail and fills those quills get stuck in the muzzle of the poor dog. Of course, dogs don't learn. I know dogs that have done it multiple times. You know, 2 weeks later, they do exactly the same thing when they come across a porcupine. So hopefully wild animals learn that that's a not a good thing to do. And there certainly are wild animals that die because of the quills. They can get infected. They continue to work their way into the skin. They're sort of designed, the little barb. So as the sort of muscles and whatever else moves, it actually goes further and further into the skin until it might even puncture something more serious. So, you know, it's not something to be laughed at. And most, animals in the wild won't make that mistake more than once.
So animals in the wild learn. Your dog tends not to
maybe
learn.
Maybe not. It might take a while. Maybe some dogs are smarter than others. But I certainly know of some dogs that have, gotten quilled multiple times.
Well, and I heard that before they will quill you, they'll try to warn you, don't come near me. They will make noises.
They will
climb a tree. I mean, they would rather not quill you.
Oh, yeah. They don't want to have, they're not aggressive. They're not looking for a fight. They're just, out and about and looking for a tree to feed on. Maybe they're in their territory and heading, to go away for the night and for the morning to find a place to sleep. And then somebody comes across them. And so they will try to get away from you. They'll try to climb a tree. They will chatter their teeth. They do make quite a loud chattering noise. But, you know what dogs are like. They just won't give up. Bark, bark, bark.
They're enthusiastic.
Enthusiastic to do whatever, play with the porcupine or see it off, and it's just not a good idea.
Well, Patrick, what are porcupines up to in the fall? Because I feel like if I see roadkill lately, it's either an opossum, which we talked about earlier, or a porcupine.
Yeah, the fall months, they're starting to transition their diet and they're transitioning their habitat use. So that's where we're seeing them move around on the ground. During the summer, they're feeding a lot on green material and they'll feed on grasses. Clover is actually one of their favorite summer foods. And as fall comes on, all those grasses dry up and their nutritional value decreases. So they start transferring over to a woody debris type diet. I call it debris. It's the cambium layer within trees. And they're changing their habitat use and they're going into more isolated areas and they're crossing roads, which causes them, because they're slow movers, to get hit by cars. And they're black. So at night, you don't see them until the last minute. They're slow movers. It's almost impossible to avoid sometimes.
Oh, that's interesting. So as their diet changes, they have to move, but they're slow and dark, as you said, and so they get hit.
Yeah.
And they like to chew on wood.
So
that's why that Vermont naturalist who I quoted was annoyed because she couldn't sleep one night because porcupines were chewing on her front porch.
So anything salty, they like to chew on. So they'll chew on plywood. There's something in the glue that is salty to them. They'll chew on that. If people touch things with sweaty hands, if ropes and things, they'll chew on the ropes. And our tires now on our vehicles are radial tires, and they're different than they were back in the early 1900s. But it used to be what was called bias ply tires, which are cords and whatnot, fabric material in a tire. And for some reason, porcupines like to chew on bias ply tires in the past, and people would complain about that as well.
Well, here's an email that came in about porcupines from Michael, who says, in my second year of organic vegetable farming, porcupines destroyed nearly my entire crop of broccoli and cauliflower. I'd go out at night and find several eating just the tips of my plants. Then to add insult to injury, they damaged many of my apple trees by gnawing the bark off branches, as you said, Pat, hastening the decline of a decades-old orchard. Thousands of dollars of produce and hours of labor chewed away by what Michael calls a walking basketball made of syringes. I'm impressed you still have a sense of humor, Michael, after what happened. Do you hear complaints like this, Pat, a lot about porcupines?
So working for a regulatory agency, I hear both sides of the coin on animals, and I've received calls like that. And as we were talking about things they ruin, I was thinking about the fruit industry. So that is a call I would completely receive within New Hampshire Fish and Game.
Again, I want to remind our listeners that we welcome your emails, your experiences. Sorry about that one, Michael. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can comment on Facebook. You can tweet us. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Well, porcupines in New Hampshire have had some struggles recently, and I did want to focus in on that for a few minutes. With us now is Dr. David Needle. He's a senior veterinary pathologist at UNH and assistant clinical professor with the New Hampshire Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. And Dr. Needle, really nice to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you've written about a deadly skin fungus that porcupines are getting. What's causing it?
It's caused by a fungus that causes ringworm and animals, common domesticated animals, as well as people. It's called Trichophyton mentangrophytes. It's one of the most common ringworm agents in dogs. It's also currently causing a pan-India epidemic of ringworm in people across the entire subcontinent of India.
Wow. So you've written that other animals, including people, can get this fungus, but that the porcupine seems to suffer the most. How come?
That's a really good question. If I had infinite money, I would study the porcupine immune system, or I wish I could find an immunologist who had infinite money and wanted to play with me. So it appears that porcupines might have a somewhat different immune reaction to this fungus than any other mammal I've ever seen. So ringworm, when you or I get it, or a cat gets it, or a dog gets it, or a cow gets it, it's a ring-shaped lesion, and that's why it has its name. And that's the immune system keeping the fungus locally contained by having a specific type of inflammatory response against it using neutrophils and macrophages, which are two key white blood cells. In the porcupine, they have almost no inflammatory reaction. And so they have this fungus growing on their skin and in their hair shafts. And the response that they have, since they don't have the appropriate immune response, is that they then try to exfoliate the fungus off by growing a lot of keratin, which would be great, except this fungus is a keratinophilic fungus.
What is keratin? Sorry to interrupt you, Dr.
Oh, keratin is a protein that makes the horns of rhinos, the hard part of our fingernails, and it's the top layer of your skin. It's a waterproof. It's the reason you can scratch your fingernails on your skin and not cut yourself. It's a waterproof, big layer of keratin. It's what flakes off.
Wow. So that's the reaction when they get this fungus. They create this keratin, but maybe that's not such a good thing?
Yeah, so the fungus is a dermatophyte, is a type of fungus, and they eat keratin, and that's their preferred substrate. So the porcupine, since it doesn't have the immune response, is trying to flake the fungus off by, growing more keratin, and then the fungus grows in the keratin because that's where it likes to live.
Oof.
And so since they can't contain it locally, they actually get covered over their entire body, and I think there's probably a good portion of the debilitation that they just can't forage and climb and feed, and also that they're expending a lot of, metabolic energy to build all this keratin, and they're not feeding well.
Wow. So it's stressful for their whole system, really. And are they dying because of this, Dr. Needle?
They were, and I assume they still are in the wild. So the animals in our study are 12 free-ranging wild animals that, as far as we know, are unrelated. And they were over multiple years brought into wildlife clinics with the disease. So they acquired it in the wild. And even initially, they weren't even able to cure them at some of the wildlife clinics until they changed to a different antifungal medication. So in the wild, I assume they are. And I actually just got an email this morning when I got back from class before you guys called me up from another wildlife rehabilitator in Maine who thinks that they have a case.
Wow. So how is this fungus related to other funguses, fungi, I'm not quite sure what the plural is, that we've heard about with other animals, especially bats, Dr. Needle?
So all of these fungi are pretty far afield from each other in the evolutionary tree of fungus. They're very different from the fungus that causes white nose syndrome, and the other big fungus that's having a large impact is the chytrid fungus, chytridomycosis, which is causing devastation to amphibian species on multiple continents. So while they are not related to each other directly as far as their evolutionary relatedness, I think there's a likelihood that they are related to each other and what is causing them to be so prevalent and impactful on multiple species at the same time, which is most likely, or at least potentially, alterations in environmental temperature.
So climate change, warmer, wetter here in New England, and creating more fungi for animals.
Right. And there are some really cool evolutionary biologists who theorize that the reason that mammals were able to survive when dinosaurs couldn't after that cataclysmic meteor or volcano eruption or whatever it was that caused that clouding of the atmosphere was that since reptiles, dinosaurs, couldn't regulate their temperature, they then became susceptible to fungus because of the difference between their environment, their temperature and the environmental temperature. Whereas mammals, since they control their own body temperature, were able to stay out of the fungus zone of the relation between their temperature and the environmental temperature. And so it may be now that a combination, like you said, of the wetter, warmer weather and the fungus being around, that we might be altering that difference.
One last quick question for you, Dr. Needle. Another disease you've seen in some wild animals recently, a distinct strain of highly contagious canine distemper virus. What are the ramifications of this being found in wild animals, without getting too detailed there?
Sure. Well, I think the most important takeaway is what Pat was saying about possums, is that we should be respecting these animals and not fearing them directly, but we should not be touching them, and we should keeping our animals from interacting with them. The strain of distemper we found is distinct, like you said, from all other strains circulating in wildlife. But if you look at a map of the United States, you could overlay a map of the different distemper strains that are in wildlife throughout the United States. And the strain we have seen has only been so far described in wildlife. We have not diagnosed that strain in companion animals yet. And I think that is because the people who own animals and the practicing clinical veterinarians in New England are doing a really good job working together to keep their animals vaccinated. And your vaccine that you use at your animal clinic for your dog should be protective against this strain of distemper.
Okay. Good to talk to you, Dr. Needle. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Dr. David Needle, senior veterinary pathologist at UNH. Before we go to our listeners, Pat, he referenced what you said earlier about, don't pick up these animals, mm-hmm. and I know you want to jump in there.
Yeah. Earlier I said do not touch them or anything like that. As a human, I know our hearts overtake our minds at times, and we absolutely want to intercede and help animals in some way. So any person that is going to not follow that advice or find an animal in a location that human intervention needs to occur to help that animal and get it to a wildlife rehabilitator, I encourage them to wear gloves, do not handle the animal barehanded at all, avoid any bodily fluids of that animal, keep themselves safe. That puts that barrier in place for those individuals that absolutely feel the need to interfere. And I do understand that need for individuals that have it.
Okay, well, let's go back to our listeners. And here's a question from a listener. Do porcupines ever shed all their quills? Anybody know, Ian?
No, I mean, they certainly replace them, I think. I mean, it's like they're essentially an extended hair. I believe they have 30,000 quills on their bodies. So when they lose them, I think they do grow, more in their place. But I'm not absolutely positive of that.
If I could say, the level of shedding is the question. So that they definitely replace them as they go, as Ian described. I have seen just one single porcupine quill on the ground walking on trails, and that certainly fell off an animal walking through, meaning that there's a replacement life of all type of hairs on animals and quills. As far as shedding, I'd say the fastest way for a porcupine to shed is when some type of animal makes a mistake and goes after it, and then it definitely sheds some quills in that process and replaces them.
Yeah. All right. Well, good question. And let's go to the phones. Mike's calling from Madison. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Just sure.
A quick point of interest. We had the porcupine, I guess the salt, as you said, attacked our brake liners on all three of our vehicles. I had to have two of them towed because the first one I limped to the garage, which was quite dangerous. We ended up catching the father, the mother, the three children, the crazy uncle. Before we were done, we had 9 porcupines in our Heverhide trap. The first one I took out to the Kank about 25 miles away, National Forest, and of course I couldn't separate the family, so it ended up costing me about a tank full of gas to get them all out there. But within 2 weeks, I had them all, and I wonder if I'm going to see more in the future. and whether it was the clover in the area that attracted them before the brake liners.
Oh, that's interesting.
A thought impression.
Yeah, well, at least you took them to a nice place, Mike, huh?
Oh, it's beautiful out there. They have water, they have food, they're all set. I think it's a better location for them.
All right, thanks for calling in. Go ahead, Pat.
So there's a lot of information in that call. A female porcupine has one young per year. So that means there was multiple possibly unrelated porcupines coming into that location. The salt could have been salt residue from salting our roadways causing that issue. And I strongly encourage people to not relocate wildlife. For one, there's rules in place that do not allow the general public to relocate wildlife. Our wildlife control operators must have written landowner permission to relocate wildlife to wherever they're bringing them, because you can bring somebody a problem. And third with this, we just talked about ringworm with these animals. You can inadvertently bring a animal that has a parasite or disease to a place that did not have that disease and spread it. So there's a number of issues relocating animals.
So have a professional do it?
Have a professional,
who knows,
yes.
You know, what the locations are that would be more appropriate.
A professional who has training and to be able to judge if the animal has disease or not, if it should be relocated in the area to release it. But I want to point out, interestingly, porcupines have one young per year.
So there's definitely some other females in that group because they only have one.
And what attracted them in that area could it be a winter den in the area for, I don't know what time of year it happened, but there's some type of habitat feature in the area that brought those in there.
Okay. Well, Sarah in Concord emailed to say, I had the good fortune to see this albino porcupine while biking in Bear Brook a few weeks ago. Is this a common thing? By the way, our producer Jessica Hunt is going to post the photo that Sarah sent us on Twitter and on our web post for today's show. And again, our website is nhpr.org/exchange. It's pretty amazing. Ian, have you heard of albino porcupines?
I've seen pictures of, I've never seen one myself. So they're as rare as any other albino animal is. They, you know, just about any animal can produce an albino. Birds as well, you can get completely white animals that are very, very unusual. So yeah, to get a photograph of one to see it is pretty, pretty unusual.
So in doing the research for the show today, I read that, and you gentlemen can correct me if I'm wrong, the only animal that preys upon porcupines is the fisher. Is that correct?
Not quite true. It's one that certainly quite frequently in here in New Hampshire preys upon them. But in other states and other parts of the country, apparently mountain lions are quite susceptible, quite like a little bit of porcupine in their diet. Other animals will certainly go after them as well. But the fisher's really proficient at it and does a really good job.
Pat?
If I could add just a little piece. Here in New Hampshire, I've handled approximately 450 bobcats that have been 95% of them struck on our roadways. And I've opened up a number of bobcat stomachs, and I have found porcupine quills in bobcat stomachs, which fascinated
really?
Me. Yeah. Yeah. It was very surprising to me because I always, you know, fisher kill porcupines, not bobcats. So now I don't know if the bobcat killed the porcupine or not, but I do know I have found quills in their stomach and they're consuming them.
Wow. Okay. Well, coming up, perfect segue, we will talk about the elusive, mysterious fisher. By the way, it is not a type of cat. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Hi, Laura Kanoy here. A reminder, this is a rebroadcast of an earlier conversation, so we aren't taking any new calls or comments. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, three underappreciated animals in the Granite State. We've been looking at opossum, porcupine, and fisher, and we're going to turn our attention now to the fisher. We welcome your questions, your observations about fishers, and they're pretty elusive, so you may not have as many stories as you have had about opossums and porcupines. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Call 1-800-892-6477. And Ian McLeod and Patrick Tate, I want to open this segment with an email we got this morning from Mead Cadeau. I'm sure you know him. He's from the Harris Center for Conservation. He tells a story from 1971 where he was visiting relatives. He says, I can still remember my first morning walk around the meadow at Wood's Edge with Newfound Lake visible in the distance. He was in Bristol, Alexandria area. I sat down under a big tree and wondered what wildlife would have been around 200 years ago. Then, Mead says, I heard a rustling above me, and not 10 feet from me was a handsome creature I'd never seen or heard of before. when my Peterson's field guide confirmed I had just seen a fisher. I was hooked on New Hampshire, Mead says. The fisher's need for room to roam has figured prominently in my efforts to create the super sanctuary, now more than 20,000 acres of contiguous protected wildlife habitat in the central Monadnock Highlands of the southwestern part of the state. Mead, it's good to hear from you. And what do you think about this story, Ian? It's lovely.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah, Mead's a wonderful, wonderful man who's done great, great work in the southwest part of the state, all over the state, but certainly his focus has been in the Monadnock region, and just a wonderful conservationist. And he's done a fantastic job creating that super sanctuary down there, both for fishers and for a whole bunch of other animals. You know, the fisher is really a fascinating animal, and it's one of the animals that I probably hear the most incorrect stories about. There's a whole bunch of stuff. I'll get people coming up to me and saying, you know, I heard that fisher cat screaming in the night last night, and they've eaten all the cats in the neighborhood, and I'm going, wait a minute. So first of all, and you mentioned this before we went to the break, they're not a cat. People, for whatever reason, call them fisher cats. The only fisher cats are the baseball team in Manchester. There's no such animal called the fisher cat. They're not a cat. They're a type of weasel, so they're in the mustelid family. They're related to mink and otters and polecats, and martens is probably their most close relative.
Sort of long, furry, slinky.
Long,
creatures.
Furry, slinky. About a cat size, certainly. Yeah. Longer tail. Males are quite a bit bigger than females. They certainly are. They're an arboreal animal again, very much a woodland animal. Great tree climbers. But they mostly feed on the ground. They feed primarily on snowshoe hares. Oh, and they don't fish. So people say, well, why do they call fisher? Apparently it comes from an old name, Fitch, which was a European name for
polecat.
Well,
lots of problems there. They don't fish.
They don't
why
fish.
Why are they called fishers?
They're not a cat.
Okay, go ahead.
But so this word Fitch apparently was, you know, ended up turning to fiché and French and Dutch and then ended up as fisher. So it's a weasel. The other thing is they don't make a lot of sound. For whatever reason, people hear screams at night and they go, oh, that's the fisher. There are lots of animals that make sounds at night in the woods and during the daytime. Foxes, raccoons, porcupines make a tremendous amount of noise. I've never heard a sound from a fisher, and I've never seen a video that proves that a fisher, the sounds that people are hearing in the woods, are actually a fisher. There are lots of videos. There's one online that's been seen 2 million times of somebody in their backyard saying, here's the sound of the fisher. They have no proof that that's a fisher. There's just screaming coming out of the woods. So for whatever reason, they have this reputation. They also have a reputation for eating cats. I'm sure they would, given a chance, but it's certainly not something that they're actively seeking out. They're opportunists if they came across a cat at night. First of all, don't leave your cat out at night. Don't let them out at all. But anyway, if you're going to do that, things are going to get to them, and you're going to end up with a vanishing cat. But it's very unlikely that it was a fisher. I think there was a study done, I don't know if it's probably Fish and Game. They examined the stomach contents, I think, of over 1,000 fisher in New Hampshire, and I think they found 2 cat hairs or something like that. Pat, you could probably jump in.
I've read the documentation. It was 1,000 stomachs from fisher. It occurred in central New Hampshire in the White Mountain regions, and according to what I read, there was one individual that had cat. There's something to consider there, though. You can bias a study depending where you do it in the state. So if you did it in a more human-developed area, you may find some differences.
Sure, it's probably not a lot of domestic cats roaming around in the White
Mountains. So, well, surprisingly, I've seen photographs of pictures of cats pretty far out in the woods from people. So anything's possible there. what I'm getting at is if you have a higher occurrence rate of these animals interacting, it can happen more. The occurrence of fisher eating cats is extremely low. It can happen. One of my first complaints as a biologist was I had advised a woman that it was relatively low chances the fisher would kill her cat, and the next day the fisher killed her cat.
So even if it doesn't eat it, it kills it?
It took the cat.
You know, fisher, we tend to anthropomorphize sometimes, but fishers do, Patrick, have a reputation for being really mean.
How well-deserved
is that?
It's not well-deserved. They'd rather avoid conflict and things like that. However, they get that reputation because when they find a food source, their drive to eat and have food is very strong, and they just block everything out from the world, and
they concentrate
on that food. So when that happens, people interpret that as being very aggressive. What it is they're doing what they need to do to survive. They're not going after people or things like that. Unless, of course, there's something biologically wrong with them, rabies or other things, which rabies is extremely rare in fisher. So that's where they get that reputation, because they become so driven for their food resources, they get this reputation of just being ruthless.
That's interesting. And unlike the other animals we've talked about, the opossum and the porcupine, they're not scavengers. It sounds like they're basically hunters, and once they are hungry and they need to hunt, they just go for it.
Primarily. I mean, you never say never. You know, they if you know, resources are low, it's a middle of winter, or they find something dead on the road that's fresh, I'm sure they wouldn't hesitate to go after it.
But they're not going to go in your garbage can like the opossum.
Not likely. Although if you had meat scraps in there, perhaps they would if it smelled good. So yeah, I mean, it's never a good idea to have any sort of food and garbage outside. So they will scavenge, but they're more of a predator. And finding their own food more than the other animals that we've talked about, or at least more than the opossum.
Got an email from Chris in Webster. He says the fisher is an important predator in New Hampshire's ecosystem, but its population has declined drastically by over 70%. And Chris attached a chart based on fishing game data to his email. He says, yet it is still hunted year-round as well as trapped with a bag limit of 2. My question is why, if the animal is in decline, why would not fishing game act proactively to help it recover? So that's from Chris and Webster. Patrick, can you address that?
Yes. So that decline is true. New Hampshire Fish and Game has acted proactively. The occurrence of fisher was much higher in the early 2000s, late 90s. All through the range saw this huge resurgence of fisher numbers, and the limit of the number of animals a person could take increased during that time. And then in the 2000s, 2005, and after, we started seeing a decline. And it's been level for the last 10 years. New Hampshire Fish and Game responded by reducing the number of individual animals a trapper or hunter could take. They are not hunted year-round. There's a hunting season that runs December 1st through January 31st. The trapping season is December 1st through December 31st. So there's a structure there to limit the number of animals taken. And the number of animals taken, given the number, we have the effort and whatnot, that trapping season and hunting, but primarily trapping, gives us a very good index to track the abundance throughout the landscape and give us a scientific idea of what's occurring with populations. If it wasn't for trapping data, nobody would know that these number of fisher or the fisher population has declined. It's the trapping data that people are using to be critical of resource use.
And what are the theories as to why fisher numbers have declined?
So in 2016, when we the question started coming up, what was going on? So I spoke to our conservation officers. Any strange acting fisher that you find, I want. And it turns out a couple of weeks later, a CO called me, had to put a fisher down. And we brought that and two trapper taken samples to Dr. Needle to have them fully necropsied, and they came back with canine distemper.
Oh, which Dr. Needle told us about.
So,
okay.
So in researching that, canine distemper is very interesting in that it is a limiting factor for young of the year and immune compromised animals. So the young of the year animals, which you won't see in your trap, if there's high reproduction, you'll see them in your trapper harvest. They fall out of the population, and that's your growth. In the state of Maine, they did some aging work, and they found that the number, the young of year per adult female was down, which indicates canine distemper impacts to a population. And my impression of everything that's going on and the way things are unfolding is that with our changing environment, as environment changes, carrying capacity changes, and diseases and parasites change. So our biological carrying capacity within the state with this changing environment is very different than it was 15 years ago. And combined with this, we have a resurgence of bobcat population on the state, a very strong bobcat population now. They are a predator of fisher, so it's a numbers game. What goes on, whichever one has a stronger population wins out, and they tend to take the smaller animals, which in this situation ends up being your adult females, which is your reproducing population.
Okay.
So there's a number of dynamics going on the landscape that we don't see because it's happening out in the woods.
Right, and I had heard that the resurgence of bobcat might be a reason why we see fewer fishers. A couple more emails have come in about fishers, and here's one from Anne in Dover, who says, I live in a wooded area where I've heard fisher cats making their shrill calls at night, so I hope Anne's listening, because Ian says that's actually
not the case.
I had taught the cat, I think she means her house cat, to go in and out a cat door, and one evening I noticed the cat using it to dash inside. When I looked up, I saw a black critter entering as well. turned out to be a fisher right behind the cat. Finally got the fisher back outside, but unfortunately the cat did not survive the frightening experience. So that gets to what you said, Ian, you know.
They are opportunists. If they're hungry and they come across a smaller cat, probably a larger cat would have a better chance of getting away from a fisher. But they're, you know, they're a powerful animal. Certainly a big male, if he's hungry, would go after it. But again, don't let your cats outside. That's the best thing.
Here's another one from Louise. We just moved from Texas to New Hampshire and had never heard of fishers. We were told we have one in our neighborhood in East Hampstead. I had seen the paw prints a couple of times and finally saw him or her on our driveway in the morning. I felt very lucky. Our neighbor has always told us to keep our cats inside due to the fisher liking the taste of cats based on their experience in the past. Wow.
Yeah, they've got a reputation, and it's going to be hard to break that reputation. As Pat said, it's, you know, fairly unusual. There are a lot of other things that are going to take your cats. They're much more likely to be hit by a car. They're much more likely to be taken by a great horned owl, coyotes, feral dogs. All kinds of things are going to go after cats. They can be quite vulnerable. Certainly a fisher would do it. There have been cases like that woman, obviously having it come through her cat flap is, you know, that's pretty good proof that that was a fisher. I'm sure that's what it was.
A very focused fisher.
Very focused fisher who was determined to have cat for dinner. And, you know, yes, that's going to happen. But do they deserve the reputation as being the great cat killer that they have? No,
oh my
definitely
goodness.
Not.
Well, we could have talked a lot more. This has been really interesting. And just real quickly, Patrick, which of these three animals we've talked about do you see most often where you live? Opossum, porcupine, or fisher?
I would say the opossum I see the most often, seconded by fisher, and then third porcupine.
By fisher, seconded by fisher. That's interesting because from what I've read, they're elusive. They like to stay in the woods. They're not kind of out there like porcupine and opossum are.
And it's a perfect point. I spend a lot of time in the woods.
Well, so, there you go. Yeah. Okay. How about you? You said you live in the lakes region.
Much more the porcupine. Yeah, we don't see opossums that often. You know, certainly sometimes I see them in towns, but the porcupines are all over the place in the lakes region. We see a lot of them.
That's interesting. And again, as I said, I live in town and I probably see opossums more than I don't think I've ever seen a fisher, and I've seen porcupines occasionally. So really interesting. Thank you both very much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure.
Pleasure being here. Thank you.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.